Hi everybody, welcome to Arnie Monkey. I'm Adam Barrow. I'm really excited to be able to introduce today's guest, Dr. John Grubstrom. John has recently finished his maximum term as the head of the World Air Sports Body, or as we know it, the FAI. We will get into the FAI a little bit later, but first I'll give you a bit of John's background. John really is a one of a kind, and you will not meet a better person in ballooning. John has had a truly engaged and committed life in ballooning and aviation more generally. He's intelligent, respectful, committed, fun, and he's completely addicted to all forms of aviation. By his own admission, his skills lie in administration. I know that sounds boring, but it's not boring at all, as you will hear. To do our sport these days, we need administrators, we need them to talk to governments and officials and allow us to fly. It's an incredibly important job, and one at which John excels. John's ballooning career started in the early 70s, and in 1974, he got his hot air balloon pilot license, and it wasn't long before he became president of his local club. In 1976, John organised the first European Championships, which was held in Sweden, and also served as the event director. In 1979, he was active again and was part of the organising committee for the World Hot Air Balloon Championships again in Sweden, and was again its director. John was the president of the Swedish Balloon Federation for 6 years and was president of the Swedish Air Sport Federation. He loves to fly and he's represented Sweden in 9 Europeans, 4 World Championships and a further 3 times at the World Air Games. He's also been an official at many international events, including World and Europeans. After 10 years serving on the FAI as a vice president, John became its president in 2010. As a testament to his efforts, he successfully completed his maximum 3 terms in 2016. He was subsequently awarded the title of FAI President of Honour, a role he still fulfills to this day. John has a host of awards to his name, including the Royal Medal of Sweden's Motor Federation for Lifetime Achievement in Aerospace, the Yuri Gagarin Gold Medal from the Federation of Aeronautical Sports of Russia, the Air Sports Sweden Gold Medal, the Royal Swedish Aero Club Gold Medal, the FAI Air Sport Medal, and the Air Sports Sweden Balloon Achievement Award. John is also a Doctor of Medicine and has spent many years in charge of emergency rooms at 2 major hospitals in Stockholm. It's an absolute honour to have John on Arnie Monkey and be able to share his fascinating life in ballooning with all of our listeners. Welcome to Arnie Monkey, John.
Thank you very much.
That was a very long intro. I apologise for that. You know, you've done too much, John. You've been too busy.
I was amazed you could dig all that out from the archives.
Well, let me start the interview off on a nice, happy note, and I'd really like to wish you a happy birthday for your birthday back in January.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, my 7th.
I understand.
Yes, incredible.
You never strike me as being that age, John. You're such a young guy in the way you go about things. You've got so much energy and, you know, just enthusiasm and such passion all the time. And, you know, that really helps to keep you young at mind, I think.
It does. I think both my ballooning and my doctoring has well, it's inspired me to keep me going, you know. So it's try to keep going at the same pace as I always have. If I relax, I probably lie down and die.
We don't want that, particularly not during this interview. That would be bad for us. So, John, take us back. We're saying 1970s is when you really got involved, and 74 for your license. When did you really see a balloon up close?
72 that was, and in 73. We decided we'd take a bank loan and buy a balloon. So we bought a Cameron balloon in 73, and it was an 084, cost us about £2,500, something like that. And we had to take a bank loan, and we were all paying £5 a month. You know, we were 24 of us who bought it together, and we formed a club, and we flew it for a while until we crashed in the forest, and then we sent it back to England and so on, as you did in the early days. You know, it was a single burner 84,000 cubic feet balloon without a skirt and when a fixed single burner that would frequently burn outside the envelope of inside. Those were the early days. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And was that the first balloon in Sweden, or were there other balloons in Sweden at the time?
No, there were other balloons in Sweden. First balloon in Sweden was hot air balloon was already in 68.
Who was that belonging to?
Oh, that was a group of enthusiastic artists in the south central Sweden. They formed a balloon and rocket club, and
they don't seem to fit very well together. But I love the idea.
Yes, they, you know, when it was windy, they were doing their rockets, and when it was calm, they were doing the balloons. So.
Is any of that crowd still involved in the sport?
To a certain extent, yes. No, they're not flying anymore, but they're still. Some of them are still around and show up at balloon meets and so on. Yeah.
And did any of them make it in becoming rocket engineers or anything like that?
Oh, they're artists, you know. They're enthusiasts. So they have different attitude to. They love the art of ballooning rather than the techniques of it.
Of course. What inspired you? Like you don't just go and you see a balloon and then say, "Well, let's go and buy one. Let's get a whole group of friends together and just go and buy one." It seems like a big step. Were you just struck straight away? Did you fly in 72? Is that really what got you engaged?
Oh, yes. I flew in 72. I probably flew 100 hours as a passenger before I got my license. Well, the fascinating thing about it then and today is the fact that you're never quite sure where you end up. So it's always an adventure. Every flight is an adventure from A to X. And I think that's the thrill about it. And it's the same today. Get in the basket, you think you'll fly to that area, but you end up in this area, and that's fun too. And then it's an adventure every flight. So that's what I love about it.
That's really my whole competition career, John, is taking up and flying a totally different direction to where I should be. So, who did you fly with on your first flight? Who was the pilot that you were flying with?
Oh, my pilot and teacher was Michael Klingberg of Oslo, a Swede living in Oslo, and he still flies. And we were together in Egypt not so long ago. And so it's been a great inspiration to me, and an old schoolmate, actually. So
really?
So we first met in 1960, believe it or not. So this old friend phoned me up and said, "Let's buy a balloon," and we did. Yeah. So it's his thanks to Michael Klingberg that I got into this business at all.
So he has a lot to answer for.
That's true. Yeah, sorry about that, Michael.
At that time, those early days in Sweden, things were sort of developing quite fast. Though you had the Europeans in 76, then the Worlds in 79. This is really happening pretty fast and maturing quite quickly, isn't it?
Oh, yes, but in those days we were young, rather wild heads, and we thought, let's fly as much as we can before the government says it's forbidden. So before there will be rules, and so we'll just enjoy the freedom of flight, because it took some time for the authorities to catch on and start to regulate the flying. We used to fly with a rope ladder and doing acrobatic tricks on the rope ladder from the basket until we had a new law in Sweden that you may not use a rope ladder from a balloon basket and things like that.
How high were the tricks being done? Like, at, you know, 2,000 feet, someone's hanging upside down from a rope ladder outside a balloon.
Well, it's not more difficult to do it from a basket than to do it from the apple tree. It's just a bit higher. It was sort of... We had the balloon taking off, and then somebody will come rushing through the crowd and say, "I want to come along," and they will throw out the rope ladder, and they will catch the rope ladder and climb on board, and we fly away. That sort of thing we were doing, just for fun.
Just because you could.
Yes, because we could.
And that's really the joy of it, isn't it? Those early days of ballooning were really very much that, you know, it was the spirit. It really was the adventure before that regulation really kicked in and started taking some of the fun out of it. Regulation is necessary to some point for safety, I get that, but it does have a tendency to take some fun away as well.
I think we need regulation, and of course the interaction with the aviation and other types of aviation is necessary to be in the system. So those early days, we were young and wild heads, you know. Now I'm more for rules and regulations. And those were the days before competition too. So nobody realized that you could actually maneuver the balloon. And so, but gradually we started to see the challenge, and we took up competition. And then we had the world championships and we had the national championships. So I thought, why not have European championships? So we decided to have the first European championship in what year was it? 76?
Yeah.
And in the west of Sweden. Unfortunately, it was a very windy week, so we only made two flights. But still, it was the first European championship.
And you ended up as the event director, John, for the event. Is that right?
Yeah, sort of my baby, more or less. And I had a very good help of my friends in the club, and we just set it up. It was hard work, actually, much more hard work than we thought, but it was great fun. Then we had the World Championships in Sweden, you know, 79. That was in midwinter, so we had the minus 20. So people were coming from New Zealand and Australia and Albuquerque and places to fly, and they came in there, and England, they came in their, you know, normal clothes. And then we had to equip them with the Arctic clothing to fly in this condition, which were very challenging because of the sharp inversions in that type of weather. So, and of course, we could fly only once a day because of the dark. So we had enormous amounts of snow, very cold, one flight a day, and the rest of the day we had a good time, really good time together.
The one thing that people should know about you, John, is that you do enjoy a party. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say, Lou. I think any excuse for a party is a good excuse.
So I can imagine those, even that event you're saying at the Europeans where it's winded out and so on, it still would have been a really fantastic atmosphere, really enjoyable, lots of friends, a few drinks to be had, and a bit of dancing would have been fantastic.
Well, we also in those days we sang a lot, so we created a lot of songs and sang together. Sort of, we had a really good time. No, I don't feel we have really the same type of social activities today in the same way. At least the singing, I don't experience today as we did in those days.
You think people are a little bit more serious today?
Or maybe distracted, or we didn't have the social media in those days. We had to interact in real life.
I'm really interested around this sort of the worlds that you had there, John. So at the time the worlds came through in 79, at that stage were you president of the Swedish Federation at that time? Or did that happen afterwards? So you sort of moved into that administration role?
That happened afterwards, yeah. I was more just a balloonist at the time.
Yeah, and just an event organizer and just the event director, when you say just a balloonist, doing everything.
Of course, there was a team, you know. We had an event administrative boss who was running all the economics and paperwork, and I was doing mainly the competition side of the event.
So how many competitors did you have in 79 at the Worlds?
Oh, there weren't that many. I think we were 37 or something like that. I think there were more in Albuquerque and so on at the previous and later championships. But considering the circumstances and the location, the time of year, we were happy with that.
It's always nice to have a World Championships there as well. Makes it much more special.
We'll see if we can have it again then.
Will you be organizing this one as well?
Of course. No, I wouldn't. We have to find. There's a young generation of good people who can do that sort of thing. So.
And so the scene at the moment, John, in ballooning in Sweden, we see the Swedes seem to be quite keen competitors. So we see them around the world at World Championships and Europeans and doing relatively well. The scene at the moment there, is it active ballooning scene? How many balloons are sort of flying in Sweden?
Well, there used to be 200 balloons and maybe 150 pilots or 200 pilots, but it has declined considerably. There was this shift, I think the same in many other countries, to go. A lot of pilots went commercial and started doing passenger rides, and then they are getting older, getting on, you know, and they gradually reducing and the regulation is getting higher and more complicated and the costs are increasing. So generally, unfortunately, ballooning in Sweden is on a decline. I think it's a generational thing. A lot of people in the 70s and 80s started up and then they kept flying and now they're gradually skipping that. And so it's rather tricky to get a license and expensive. So we don't have that many young pilots coming in a second wave, sort of.
In Australia, for instance, we're seeing quite a strong second generation, you know, the children of balloonists starting to come through. Are you seeing that at all or not so much?
Well, I'm very pleased. My son has got a license and is doing quite well. And there are a few such, but not that many as I would hope.
That's a shame.
Well, we'll have a new rise again, but it's sort of, I think it's a generational wave sort of thing. Comes to flow like a the wave comes in and then it goes out and then it comes in again. So we'll see. We'll have a new rebirth, I'm sure. But many countries, as you say, in many countries there is a young generation flying. So that's I have good hope for future ballooning too.
Yeah, as do I. I think you're right. It's definitely that generational change. And I think the waves are really nice description of it. It's a good way of visualizing that. The other thing that's happening, of course, at this same time in the 70s and onwards, the thing that's allowing you to go ballooning all the time, which is your work, and you're a doctor of medicine. When did you finish that, John? Were you flying balloons first, or was that at university while you were also studying medicine, or were you already practicing as a doctor when you took it up?
I got my license start practicing later on, but having worked in emergency medicine, there's a lot of weekends and nights, and in my country you're compensated for working off hours by getting time off, and so hours compensated with hours, so I could work a lot in the emergency room, and then I would get a lot of free time so I could go ballooning somewhere. So it was an excellent type of work. It's not sort of an office 9-to-5 work. I could work, one week nights and then the weekend, and then I might have 10 days off because of that. So that's how I've been able to participate in so many events around the world, because of this type of fortunate working schedule.
And did you always want to be a doctor when you were growing up? You know, kids always want to be different things. But was doctor high on the list for you? Do you come from a family of doctors?
No, not at all. Although I have an uncle who was a doctor. But but it was high on the list all the way, because being a doctor, if you have an education in medicine, there are so many opportunities to find something you really like to do. And anything from, you know, psychiatry to brain surgery. So there's such a spectrum of opportunities within that education. So I thought that was a good start, and I never regretted it, that's for sure.
What else was on the list? If doctor was high up, what else was high on your list when you were a kid? Was it like astronaut and things like that? Was that in the running for you?
No. You know, when I grew up, my father was worked in insurance, and I gradually realized that he had a previous life being a airman. So he was a bush flyer in the United States and Canada, and did all sort of crazy things, but before I was born, and I have some sort of crazy aviation genes, I suppose, but I wasn't really aware of that, but. No other dreams I had at those days. No, it was something. I wanted an education that gave me a broad opportunity. It could be law, it could be diplomacy, it could be, you know, but I thought medicine seemed to be a pretty good way you could help people and have a good life. So I was fortunate after quite a struggle to be accepted at the medical school, and that's as I was quite hardworking to get into the medical school.
You've chosen, obviously you were working in emergency rooms, as you were saying before, but you sort of progressed from there, didn't you? And your aviation and your medical career have sort of intercepted, and you've really started specializing in aviation medicine. Is that right?
Yeah, That's right. I do have a specialty in that, but my medical career gradually became more administrative, and I was chief medical officer at the Karolinska Hospital and at another university hospital. So I gradually, as I grew older and then not quite able to work nights and shifts in the emergency room, I gradually had other more administrative work. So I made an administrative career also in medicine and in aviation, you could say, in parallel. So I guess I'm an administrator. That's you boil it all down. That's I'm a paper man.
Well, I think that's probably doing yourself a disservice. I imagine that the training that you had in medicine and that bedside manner, do you think that's helped you later in life having to deal with sports administrators?
Oh, sure. It's medicine is a people interaction work, and you speak to thousands of persons in difficult circumstances and their relatives and all that, and it makes you gives you the higher ability, I think, to read the other person's mind and to have a more understanding on their view of what's going on, which I think might have helped me in my various negotiations in FAI and so.
It's just such a fascinating story yours, John, with the synergy between the meeting of the two, you know, your two worlds in a way, being administrator in both. Is quite clever.
I've been very, very fortunate in my life. It's not being clever; it's being fortunate. But it's not luck, but it's being fortunate. So I like the distinction between being lucky and being fortunate. The fortunate person is the effect of so many variables. Lucky is throwing a dice, you know, you get a six and you're lucky. But being fortunate is thousands of variables, most of them below your personal radar, but they pull in the certain direction, and I've been very fortunate. So through, you know, from my growing up and the my parents and living under good circumstances and so on. And I consider myself extremely fortunate.
Just wanted to move on to the FAI. Was it something that you aspired to? Like, you know, I know administrations run, you know, through your career. Was it a natural step for you to then move into the FAI?
Oh, yes. In the FAI, every country has a representative. And it's normally the chairman of the National Aero Club or National Air Sport Coordinator. And then I got to know the world of FAI. That's unfortunate. Fortunately, maybe still is rather unknown to most air sport persons. But it's the international body for all sports and records and the promotion of the air sports. And in that environment, I made a lot of new friends and I got to understand the situation for air sports in different countries, which is very different from country to country. And also the national support is very different. You know, the Olympic Committee or the sport department of the nation supports the sports in the country, but in some countries air sports get support, and in most countries air sport do not get support, although air sport is recognized by the International Olympic Committee. So that challenge, I thought, was one important challenge we should try to do something about. And there's so many issues, I thought, oh, we have to do something about this, and I like the environment. So one day I decided, when the time was for a new president, I decided I'll run for president, see what I can do about it. And I was fortunate to be elected. Rather unknown person, but I think from medicine I knew how to make a presentation. And when you want to get elected, it's the lobbying, and then it's how you introduce yourself. And maybe you need to be extrovert, and I think I can be extrovert when necessary.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. What you were saying about a lot of people don't really know about the FAI, I think you're right there. And it's an amazing organisation. It really is an incredible organisation. And so for those listeners, because we've got a range of listeners, pilots, crew, just enthusiasts to the sport as well. So for maybe those people, John, who don't know the FAI, can you maybe give them an idea of the disciplines that the FAI is responsible for?
Okay, well, first, it's the World Air Sport Federation. It has more than 100 countries are members, and so each country is a member, and they get the vote at the FAI General Conference depending on how many air sport persons are estimated to be in each country. So that's how the democracy works in that organization. It organizes or ratifies the records and the championships in almost anything that flies. So starts with aero modeling, all types of aero modeling. You know, there are a lot of different types of aero modeling, and now also drones. So there are FAI World Championships for drones. And goes on like this with, of course, balloons and airships, gas and hot air. It's gliding, all types of parachuting, also indoor skydiving. Oh, general aviation, aerobatics, parachuting, paragliding, hang gliding. We also have astronautical records. So I've had the honor to give certificates and medals to various astronauts and to Elon Musk once because of the SpaceX. I'll tell you a story. Once I was at the National Aeronautical Association gala dinner for awards, and their president got up on stage, of course, and said, "Welcome to everybody." And he said, "Particularly want to welcome Dr. John Grubstrom, president of the World Air Sport Federation." So I stood up and everybody applauded. And I sat down and I thought that was very kind of him. And then he said, "We also want to welcome Neil Armstrong." Very, very weird moment in my life, actually.
So you were introduced before Neil.
Yes, that was very strange to me, but great, great honor, of course. But it's sort of moments in my presidency that I really remember is moments like that.
Did you get to meet Neil and talk to him?
Oh, yes, we see that. I talked to a lot of nice people there, the Elon Musk, Neil Armstrong, Baron Hilton, etc. So, yes, a great, great event to be at.
Amazing opportunities.
So I'll tell you, compared to many other sport federations, the FAI is extremely active regarding the number of events. We have, more than 50 world or continental championships every year. And a lot, as you know, a lot of recognized events, hundreds of recognized events in various sports, and also several hundred records every year, sport records. And compared to most other sport federation, they don't have any records at all. We keep setting new records.
I think I read it said since foundation in 1905 that there's been over 16,000 world and continental records that have been ratified by the federation. That's incredible numbers.
Yeah, and we have an enormous archive. You know, we have all the paper from Yuri Gagarin to Graf Zeppelin to Charles Lindbergh. Lot of, and of course, all the transatlantic and around the world records with balloons, trans-Pacific flights of Roy Bradley, etc. We have all the paperwork in our files. It's most amazing. And since 1905, can you believe it?
So it's like a living museum, isn't it?
Yes. Anybody write a paper on the sport development, they could be very welcome to the FAI archives.
You look at that and you go, those sort of numbers, and you're saying like 500 a year, that sort of stuff, that's a lot of people doing some really incredible things every year, isn't it?
And a lot of volunteers. Yeah. We have so many volunteers that are registered in our databases for judges, observers, stewards, jury members, all this needed in all the various sports. So it's more than several thousand persons are registered in the database in these capacities. And I'm very grateful to them because they do a lot of volunteer work in the background. You know, somebody sets a record, but somebody has to measure it and ratify it and do the paperwork. Somebody wins a championship, but it's all those people in the background doing the the task setting and the scoring and etc. So there's a lot of volunteers in the background in our sports.
And the FAI is also involved with the Red Bull Air Race, isn't it, John, I think, as well?
The Red Bull Air Race is a world championship in particular one of our many world championships, yes. Mm. They do have hundreds and thousands of spectators. And, of course, a lot of activity on the internet. So they're very successful. And if you get a chance to go and see a Red Bull Air Race, you won't regret it because it's very exciting and very well covered by, for the public attending.
There's a maximum of three terms. Is that right, John? So two-year terms, and there's a maximum of three for a president. Is that right?
That's right. Maximum of 6 years, yeah.
6 years. So you did your 6 years. Incredibly successful. And so you run into that 6 years, and so you then move out of the presidency, the new president comes in, and you take on the position of the president of honour. Can you explain what's involved in that role and what your activities are now?
Oh, well, as it says, it's an honorary position, and it's just actually it's quite a change in life from being the president to being the past president. And so it's a bit of a vacuum actually, but then it means I'm available as a resource for the new president and the new executive board if they need somebody to look into a matter, make an investigation. I'm just a resource person for them.
Okay.
If they want somebody to hand out a medal in some remote place they don't have time to go to, I'm happy to go there. And so. And I just done a few such jobs that I enjoyed very much. The first, I went to the ballooning fiesta at Clark Air Base in the Philippines. It's an enormous event with many tens of thousands of spectators and all sorts of air sports. In fact, they have the slogan, anything that flies. And they had, you know, night flying with the paramotors and the flybys by the Air Force and wing walking and, of course, balloons and special shapes and all that. And we're looking at that event to be a potential location for some type of FAI competition in the future. That's
sure.
Why. It's very good because it's in February. And otherwise, the rest of the world is rather, there's not much competition going on in February. So this is a location with the infrastructure and the weather for a competition in February. So that would be good. And I'm writing a positive report about that. I also recently represented FAI at the World Military Sport Federation. Believe it or not, there is such one. It's called the Conseil International de Sport Militaire, CISM. And they celebrated their 70th birthday or anniversary. So I was there representing FAI, and that's a very interesting organization because they do a lot of different sports that are more or less related to armed forces of different countries, and they have the slogan, friendship through sport. You will find persons from all sort of parts of the world, even North Korea, taking part in these events and making friends. So it's an action for peace, this CISM, that I respect very much. And they celebrated their 70th anniversary in Nice in France just a few days ago. So I was there. Since some air sports are connected to CISM, that's parachuting and also general aviation, navigational. So we have a memorandum of understanding with this organization.
What were your emotions when you became president of the FAI?
Well, of course, it's an overwhelming feeling that you actually successfully run your nomination campaign and you're elected. But it's also it's a great pleasure and happiness to be elected, and you see all, you have your vision of where you want to go. It's a you know, highway towards the sunrise. But then as you go along, there are a lot of bumps on the roads and curves. Sometimes the weather isn't that good, and sometimes the road is more gravel than highway. But so that's a lot of challenges, and quite a lot of firefighting. So you can both the strategic work and the firefighting. It's a challenging mix, but I have such a fantastic, or had a, such a fantastic staff in Lausanne, where the head office is. It's just 10 people, but they're doing an incredible job under the Secretary General Susanne Schördl and the Sport Director Marcus Hagenay, the balloonist.
Is there also a bit of trepidation when you get the position, John? Like, you sort of start thinking, gee, I've got the campaign, I won the campaign, got the election, that's great. I really hope I don't balls this up.
No, why should you do that? No, you're just human and you do your best. What more can you do? Everybody realizes there's a life on the side as well. You know, you have your private life. You have your. I mean, the presidency is not a salary. It's volunteer work and takes a lot of time. But you have to make money as well to survive, and you have to keep your family going and so on. So it's everybody realizes that, and just as long as you do your best and are open to what people think and say and listen and so on. No, I wasn't worried about that. If they don't like me, they can kick me out.
Hi, we hope you're enjoying this episode. Just a quick reminder that you can support Auntie Monkey by going to patreon.com/AuntieMonkey or going to the donate page on AuntieMonkey.com, where you can pledge as little as $1 per episode that will help us get all the software, the hosting, and the equipment that we need to produce better quality podcasts for you. Anyway, enough from us. Back to the episode.
And did you have to do any research on when you got the job? Did you have to do research on some of the air sports and really get to know them a bit better? Things like drone racing. Did you know much about it?
Not much at all. But I early realized the potentials of we needed to get the drones on board. Our federation or some other federation would be invented. No, it's the FAI is built up through commissions. In ballooning, it's the CIA, is the ballooning commission, and in each commission there's a president and an expert. And twice a year, I meet all these. The president of FAI meets all these presidents to get an update on what's going on. And it's quite a good dialogue or opportunity to, if you have a question or something you want to learn about a particular sport, it's through these commissions. So the know-how is there. So it's just like a company, actually, if you look at various departments. And we'll see the World Championship for drones, I think, in the autumn in China, in a place called Shenzhen. Mm. So that would be a big event.
While you're president of the FAI, there's really incredible records that happened as well. Things like Fedor's round the world flight was, I think, right at the end of your tenure, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that's right.
And then we had two eagles with Troy and Leonard going across as well, the Pacific. But then we also had some other things happening in aviation as well, because you had the Solar Impulse
for sure
does go around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also had the huge profile events like the big, you know, parachute jumps and for Felix Baumgartner happening as well, as and to a lesser extent also the ones for the one with Alan Eustace as well. So really some big things happening in there at that time while you were at the helm. That's, you know, for you, what are the sort of the big ones that really stand out in your mind that were real highlights for you in the records?
Oh, well, you did really mention some highlights. And of course the Solar Impulse was not just the FAI record and the big achievement. It was also a great hope and for a future of electric flight. And they really proved that it was possible. And we now see this fast development of electric everything. So I think they're really pioneers and should have all the credit for and admiration for what they did. It was quite a tough job to fly solo in an electric plane over the Pacific and so on. So that was probably the because there's so many dimensions to it. Otherwise, I think the World Air Games in Dubai was probably the one of the highlights of my presidency, because we managed to bring together all the airsports in one place in Dubai for an amazing event, thanks to the generous support of the United Arab Emirates, so in Dubai.
Yeah, every airsport that you talk to, or every balloonist you talk to who was there, or any person who attended at all, still rates that as probably the highlight air sports event they've ever seen in the world. Quite incredible with that setting and the location, wasn't it? It was really quite stunning.
It was some really amazing balloon rides, some really amazing parachuting events, some really amazing even gliding. Nobody thought you could do gliding in a desert country, but the gliding competition was great, and they were soaring on the up of the hangwinds of the skyscrapers, you know. Yeah, we had all sports in one place, and that the World Air Games is alive, and it will happen again. As you might know, we'll have the World Air Games in Turkey in 2020.
In Turkey. It's already been there once, hasn't it?
Yes.
Was it the first one in Turkey, I think?
That's right, in Cappadocia. Yeah. The ballooning was in Cappadocia, where there's so many passenger rides now after that.
There's also some challenges, it's fair to say, along the way in some events during your time as well.
Well, the major challenge has been to bring in the big money to keep the organization alive, because we have so many things we want to do, and we need to get the support from various corporations. So the new president has also found some new money, so we're quite stable organization. We do have quite a basis of. But we've done a lot of investments too that we hope will develop the sport further, like the World Air Games Tour, the World Tour for competition on different places. That's being launched, and there may be Clark in the Philippines could be one of these locations.
Could be one of those, yeah. That sounds like an amazing initiative. When's that due to launch, John?
Oh, we're working on it. Okay. We need to get the tour. We're looking at Formula One and things like that. Try to see if we can find something similar for air sports.
Not, I think it's a great idea.
Not all air sports, but for a few air sports, and then get some. We need to get some more role models and poster names and the stories around persons, etc. You're doing a great job with your show for promoting individuals. So thank you.
Thank you for coming on it. What I was going to say, John, is from my view, from the outside looking in, it seems like your term as president, you sort of went about almost trying to, I don't like the word, but modernize the FAI a bit and give a bit more of a corporate structure.
Well, I think it'd be more fair to say that we went to be a more global organization. One of my efforts was to open up FAI to be not just the Western countries and Europe, but also be a global organization. And we did a lot of work to get the Asian countries more on board. So I'm very pleased with the development in Southeast Asia, where, you know, there are so many young people who are very eager to do air sports, and they take Indonesia. They have more than 200 million inhabitants, all young and keen, and they do wonderful paragliding, etc. But before, in the earlier, let's say 10 years ago, the FAI was more Eurocentric and less open mind. So we created what we call the Air Sport Federation of Asia, and so the countries of Asia can interact not just through FAI but through their own regional organization to support each other. So I'm very pleased with that development. So they're very active now in all over the place in Asia, particularly Eastern Asia, and also in the Arab countries. And so it's less Eurocentric and more global.
Was the organization very happy to move with it, or was there some resistance?
Well, I mean, there's Western Asia and Eastern Asia and Southeast Asia and Northern Asia. So it's a big part of the world. And of course, there are different cultures and different views on how to run a regional organization, who's to be in charge, etc. But generally, it's been quite smooth. And now they seem to be on very good speaking terms. And So China and Japan and Southeast Asia and the Arab countries are working together to support the development of air sports. And I think we'll see a lot of new activities both in the Middle East and also in Asia. And of course, China is a major motor in this, and we are very pleased that they are more involved in FAI activities now. We had a big event not that long ago in Wuhan in China, which is a very big city and a fantastic event. So FAI event. So we will hear more about Wuhan in the future.
Is there an opportunity for ballooning up there as well, John?
Absolutely. There was ballooning there and quite soft winds.
And do you see China as do you see that as an opportunity for growth in ballooning? Do you see that, you know, that Asian tiger sort of really developing and coming through in ballooning as well, or more generally other air sports?
Well, there's a lot of ballooning going on in China, but the rapid development is in microlights and that type of activity, trikes and paramotor and that type of light aviation, you could say. That's general aviation, and particularly microlight is where the fast development is. And ballooning is there and it's growing, and the airspace is becoming more available, and quite a lot of balloonists in China, and they're quite good. You'll see their own burners and their own envelopes and their own baskets, but you don't recognize the brands as you do in other places, but they're very good, actually.
It's like every other country, John, isn't it? Everybody's started somewhere, so it makes sense they're developing their own products, especially when there's so much manufacturing up in China. They have cheap fabric ready to go. They're manufacturing it. The materials are ready to go. So it makes sense they should develop that skill set quite quickly. A question I'm really interested in, John, is your only form of aviation is ballooning. You're not a pilot in any other discipline, are you?
Well, I used to have an airship license a while, but I dropped it, yeah. But that's not anything else than that, no. Unfortunately, but there's only this much time in life.
How is ballooning perceived by the other sport aviation disciplines?
Well, I think they're quite a neutral view. It's one air sport, just another air sport, and there's no competition or envy or any other aspect. I think all air sport representatives respect each other. And if you're an aeromodelist or a parachutist or a glider pilot or a balloonist, we're all the same. I have no perception of any difficulties or hard feelings or envy or. No, it's just you love yours. We're all enthusiasts and passionate about our sports. I'm a passionate balloonist, and somebody else is a passionate drone racer and passionate glider. You know, our Secretary General, Susanne Schödel, she's a world champion in gliding and has world records in gliding, but she's the Secretary General for all air sports. So not that many are doing everything. You just can't do everything.
Where do you see the FAI developing over the next sort of 5 to 10 years under the new leadership?
We're going Olympic. We are going Olympic, and we're gradually getting much more questions and discussions with the Olympic movement. Thomas Bach, the IOC president, is a great supporter of FAI, and we are now taking part in the Asian Games. The Asian Games, which is an enormous competition event, bigger than the Summer Olympics, and we will have air sports there with the paragliding accuracy, and organized by the Olympic Committees of Asia, the OCA. The Olympic Committees of Asia is a sort of a regional department within the IOC. So an Olympic organization is arranging an event where air sports are taking part. And so we are gradually getting there. And I'm personally quite optimistic of seeing air sports in the Winter Olympics in China.
Really?
Yes, 2022.
Which air sports do you think will be targeted?
Now, that depends on what they would like to have. But You know, whenever you go to a winter resort, you will see air sports.
Yeah.
And one of those air sports is natural in a winter setting, would be natural to bring into Olympic Games. And they're looking for new sports in the Winter Olympics. So I even heard they were considering snow volleyball, believe it or not. doing volleyball instead of on sand, or they do it on snow. That's not a winter sport, is it? But you don't see volleyball if you go to a winter resort, but you will see air sports. And one of those air sports, or maybe even some variation, we're looking at speed flying or a vol de ski. It's skiing with a small kite. It means that you can fly a few hundred meters and touch down on target areas. You can have a giant slalom with this kite and do that in formal ski slope. So I thought that would be my priority, but maybe an organizer would have some other air sport they want to have. So, but we're pushing in the right direction, and we will go Olympic one day, that's for sure.
Some aviation in Winter Olympics would be just fantastic. That'd be awesome. I was just thinking when you were saying about snow volleyball, John, I was really hoping that the volleyball players aren't wearing the same outfits they wear at the Summer Olympics on the snow. It could be a bad outcome. John, one of the things that I like to talk to people about, you've seen so much ballooning around the world, and we're back onto ballooning a bit more now. In your country, you're seeing a decline in ballooning. We've seen that a bit here, and other people I talk to as well, it's declining. In some countries, it's really booming. And I'm wondering if you've got a view on what we can do globally to really reinvigorate the sport of ballooning.
Well, there are some very good examples. One is the youth camps. You have youth camps for balloonists. There's been some very successful such in Germany and Switzerland and Austria and so on, I'm sure in other places, where you bring in teenagers and introduce them, or young people introduce them to ballooning, take them for rides, and start learning them, teaching the basics. I think youth camps should be supported by our balloon federations and our national sport federations and so on. We should make our government and the sport departments aware that air sports are a very good way of activating young people that today might be sitting in the boiler room getting fat and diabetic and hypertension playing their computer games. They will never join the soccer team, but they could join the air sport team, and that would bring a lot of better life to them, both socially and from general health point of view. So we should target the authorities and say, look here, there's a great bunch of young people who are at risk from a health point of view. They will never go athletic, but we can activate them and get support for that. But youth camps, I think, is a good idea. And generally through the national aero club or air sport coordinator, try to have young people to get them involved in all sort of air sports, but of course ballooning is number one.
Like your mode of access, John, into the sport was through a club, you know, getting with 24 people and paying small shares. That sort of died away a bit, hasn't it? People tend to go and buy their own piece of equipment and fly their own balloon, and it sticks, and they try and get their own crew and everything. Do you think there's an opportunity for that club-based ballooning to come back into fashion?
Frankly, no. I think young people today, if you look at the golf club, nobody wants to be the treasurer of the golf club. Everybody wants to play golf, and they will just buy their little slot and do their round and go home. And people want to buy their experience, and not as many today want to do voluntary work, I think. So it's a challenge. But so the idea of you find a balloon and you make a small group around your balloon, and that's just fine with me. That's a small club, in my opinion, and the one balloon, one group is one club, and you but they should join the national organization and be a part of the development of the sport, not just doing their thing in their local area.
When I talk to people in Europe, as an example, is the one thing that everybody's getting particularly worried about is regulation and over-regulation of air sport, which is either making it much more expensive to fly or it's making it much less accessible to fly through, you know, more rules or restrictions on flight areas or whatever it might be. Do you think there's an opportunity in there for national federations to lobby governments to help with those rules?
Oh, it's a necessity. We must all be, whenever we go to a dinner party, we must talk about this, the over-regulation of air sports. But at least in Europe now, there is some light in the tunnel. We've gone from a situation with over-regulation and to strict regulation that is sort of, jumbo jet regulation is applied to ballooning. We now have in Europe, through the European Aviation Safety Agency, EASA, a much better understanding for air sports. And I see a positive development. We have an organization called the Europe Air Sports, and they have a memorandum of understanding with FAI. So they're doing a lot of good work to ease the over-regulation. And the EASA today has better understanding for this. I have a feeling that they realize that we need air sports. If we want to have airline pilots in the future, we need to have air sports today. So we have a positive tendency to downgrading of over-regulation. But we need regulation and we need the mutual understanding that aviation is developing very rapidly and the airspace is being much more used today than just 20 years ago. So we need to respect that. And we should have our airspace, and they have international travel and so on should have their airspace. And we should be able to live together. And they don't need all airspace, and we don't need to be in the airspace they need. So we should be able to live together. And I think we're going that direction.
We really need to have our subject matter experts for ballooning in particular inside talking to those people as well, don't we? So making sure that they understand what we're trying to do in ballooning so that we don't get lumped with jumbo jet rules, as you say.
Yes, and whenever we have, most people involved in air aviation regulations are enthusiasts. They are passionate mostly about general aviation, and they understand what air sport is, but we just make friends with them and we have a much easier life rather than writing angry letters to their superiors. That's not a good way to ease regulation.
I think it's the same for life, John. Writing angry letters to your boss doesn't help with anything or to your wife. None of these things help. So and that's a nice leading, because that's the last thing I want to talk to you about. You, no man is an island. All these things that you've been doing, these amazing experiences and opportunities you've had, you need a fantastic support network at home to allow you to do them. What does your wife think of this obsession you have with ballooning?
Oh, well, I made that very clear when we got married. I said, you have to realize I'm obsessed with ballooning. And so we had a lot of wonderful flights together, and she's been very supportive, Eva-Lena. So I'm most grateful to her and my family in general for they accept my weird, unusual hobby. But so I haven't had a problem with that. But as you say, no man is an island, and whatever I have achieved, I haven't achieved on my own. It's thanks to the wonderful surrounding I had. So I have this saying, with the help of my friends, whether it's the FAI staff or the ballooning club or the family, but with the help of my friends, I managed quite well. It's not my doing. It's sort of the whole infrastructure moving in the right direction.
Very well said. That'll get you some brownie points if your wife's listening in too. This is good. Thank you, John, for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
But great talk to you, Adam, and thanks for having me on your show. I'm very pleased with what you're doing, and I wish you all success with broadening your listening base.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks again for your time.
Okay. Ciao. Soft landings.
Hi again. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. Just a reminder that you can subscribe to Auntie Monkey via the website www.auntiemonkey.com. You can also subscribe through iTunes or on your Android podcasting app if you really don't like Apple gear. Keep sharing Auntie Monkey on Facebook so that we can make sure as many people as possible can listen. If you write for a local ballooning magazine, why not put in a little plug for us in there as well? In return, you'll receive some great karma. You can give us feedback or suggest guests for us on our Facebook site at www.facebook.com/AuntieMonkey666 or even ask us why we have the number of the beast on our Facebook URL. Thanks for listening.